Hey everyone. Today's book takes lessons from poker and applies them to your daily life, which is why I just lost my house to the mob. It's Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke, a world-class poker player who shares how to make better decisions in your job, romance, healthcare, and gambling with your 401k.
And this is The Book Pile. I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and I also wrote a book about the only casino game that I know how to play, called Pondering with Craps.
That sounds like the Rodin sculpture on a toilet.
The Stinking Man.
And I'm David Vance. I read this book about data-driven decision-making so I would be more attractive to women. They love a guy who knows the word heuristic.
All right, if you want to see me live, go to KellenErskine.com. I'll be updating my calendar soon with some new 2023 dates. Not for the year. I have 2023 gigs coming up.
All right, I also have a little plug. Next week, January 10th, I'm launching a Kickstarter for a project that I am very, very excited about. It's called The Starlings Adventure Box. It is a graphic novel escape room. So basically, a box arrives at your door, you read a graphic novel, and every time the characters hit obstacles, you have to solve puzzles to get them through it. So it's ages 10 and up. You can play with adults, you can play with kids, or you can just buy the graphic novel. That is coming January 10th, and I would be thrilled if you buy it.
I also love, of all the discussions we've had on audiobooks, the first book that you write is not available as an audiobook.
I should try to make one. So in this panel, the girl is like making kind of a grossed out face. And
no, but I am very excited about this too. I was able to get my hands on a copy before publication, Don't Tell Dave. And my kids have been having a ball with it. It's awesome.
Finally, our next two books are The Starlings by me and The Namesake. All right, I really liked this book, Thinking in Bets. It's one of those books that makes you realize how complex the world is and how you're probably overconfident about a lot of things. My trouble is, I just wish I knew which things.
So Dave recommended this book to me. I loved it too, because it's already brought me peace, specifically on the principle of when blaming something on bad luck is bad, and then when it's actually good. I also love that she writes about how to regret things better. All of this sounds weird, but it'll make sense in a few minutes. Also, I don't know how to play poker, so if this entire book is bluffing, just don't tell me. All right, and without further ado, here are four lessons that we took from Thinking in Bets.
Lesson one, beware of resulting. Kellen, I want to give you a story problem. One weekend, you decide to take your wife to a classical music concert, and you get there a little early, and it turns out they're still setting up the stage. So as you're walking down the aisle, a crane slips and drops a grand piano on you, just flattens you. Your spine collapses. You die screaming in front of your wife with no dignity. All copyright of The Book Pile reverts to me, your enemy. So that's the setup. Here's the question. Was going to the concert a bad decision?
I think at that point, starting a podcast with you was a bad decision.
Now, a lot of people say, yeah, that's a bad decision. You got killed by a piano. But Annie Duke says... Annie Duke says it wasn't a bad decision. It was a good decision with bad luck. Because if you go to a million concerts, 999,999 times, no piano falls on you. So she says, instead of judging decisions by what happened, we should judge them by whether the decision-making was good and then recognize there's luck and uncertainty in the mix.
Yeah, she also mentions never go to 1 million concerts.
I had sort of the opposite scenario happen where when I was young, I bought some Bitcoin before it went up, and I concluded the reasonable thing, which is that I was a gifted investor with the burden of genius. And only later did I realize, oh, you had zero knowledge of anything. You just got lucky.
I don't mean to correct you, but a true opposite example would have been if you were singing in an opera and then fell from a great height and killed a piano. If that ever is my fate, which, by the way, I'm not totally against, I would want my epitaph to read, from the book pile to the Kellen pile.
Speaking of Looney Tunes deaths, what is an anvil used for besides dropping on people? Is it like a blacksmith thing?
That's what I always imagined, someone hammering like a hot sword onto it, but I guess I don't really know what the pointy end is for.
Anyway, her point is, if you only look at results, you're ignoring luck and you're ignoring uncertainty and you're going to make worse decisions.
Speaking of opposites, I also like the opposite example that she gives of, if a drunk driver is able to make it home, the next morning when they sober up, they're not thinking that that was a good decision.
Yeah.
So it goes on the other end of it too. Actually, I have a real life example where this book helped bring significant emotional peace to me already. Just 2 weeks ago, me and my wife and my boys, we went out to look at Christmas lights, and 30 minutes later, hit some big debris in the road. It crushed something in my engine.
Oh no.
And we had to pull to the side of the road. And it was a whole mess. We had to leave the car there. The next day, I waited for 6 hours for a tow truck to get there. But during this time where I was waiting for the tow truck, I was actually listening to this book. And she talked about this very thing. The timing was just so perfect, because I was absolutely trying to blame myself for something that I must have done that night to cause this. I found out later that my wife was feeling unnecessarily guilty as well, just coming up with dumb reasons. Like, if only I would have grabbed my other beanie on the way out, that 10 seconds would have made the difference.
Sure.
Or if we had chosen this different route to drive tonight. But neither of those things are right or wrong. And what we were doing wasn't a bad decision in the first place.
Right.
It was actually probably one of the most wholesome things you can do. We just then had some plain old dumb bad luck. And listening to this book and realizing that enabled us to take an unnecessary emotional weight off of our shoulders. It's really nice. Everyone should try it. All right. Lesson two, regret stuff in the future.
I think you only say future like that.
So Duke quotes Thoreau, who said, "To regret deeply is to live afresh," which is similar to a quote of mine. "To regret deeply is to go to Winnipeg in January." Also, the previous but less famous part of his quote, still speaking about the value of regret, he says, "Tend and cherish it till it comes to have a separate and integral interest."
Huh.
I just think sometimes quotes make more sense to you when you hear the first part, like how Lincoln started the Gettysburg Address with, "What's up, America? Here's an insane way of saying the number 87. Anyway, tending your regret until it has separate interests. I thought that is such a wonderful way of saying that there's value in separating the regret from the self, instead of holding on to what caused it, just using it to learn from and live better in the future. I know that it's easier said than done, but I also know that I started improving at comedy so much faster when I stopped dwelling on a bad show, which in the beginning was most of them, and just focused on how it could be better next time. Like how Thoreau also said, quote, "Back to the lab again, yo, this whole rhapsody, better go capture this moment," end quote.
You're going to lose yourself in the woods.
Annie Duke also brings up the idea of giving your regret a time machine and killing Hitler. No. Also, a book by Hitler would have been called Losing Bets. She just means that before making a decision, you can project the possibility of how you might regret it into the future.
Yeah.
You brought this up before, Dave, the idea of a premortem, where instead of planning for success, you plan for failure to anticipate potential obstacles. Like, hey, check to see if Winnipeg is sometimes colder than Antarctica.
It's a lot of really specific examples.
So my takeaway from this is, with all his talk about how great regret is, Henry David Thoreau definitely had some huge skeletons in his closet.
All right, lesson three. When you ask advice, don't say the result. This is a short one. I once had this debate with my sister where she was upset about this person I voted for because of what they did in office. And for any listener wondering who it is, it's the politician you hate the most, and I did it to destroy America. Anyway, my sister was mad at me because of what they did, and I said, look, no one predicted they would do that. You shouldn't judge me based on what we know now. You should judge me based on what we knew when I voted. And she agreed with me, so I experienced the cocaine high of winning an argument, the most transcendent joy in the world.
I was just going to say, that's the only marriage advice I give anyone.
Never lose an argument.
Only go to bed after you've won.
Never go to bed angry. Go to bed victorious.
My bed is actually set up in two tiers as a first place pedestal.
By the way, one time, two roommates and I were driving to go vote in the primary. And on the way there, we realized we were each voting for the three leading candidates. So we just turned the car around. Anyway, Annie Duke has this process where she gets advice from other poker players and she describes the hand of poker and asks what the right decision was, but she doesn't tell them who won. And that way they have to give advice with the same amount of ignorance that she had when she was making the decision. Mm. And I think that's a really smart way to get advice.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lesson four, learn from those who beat you. Let me finish.
Kellen went to a very strict boarding school.
Jean Cocteau said, we must believe in luck, for how else are we to explain the success of those we don't like? Just so unfortunately relatable. She writes that some of the best poker players use their time immediately after losing to give credit to others and explore personal mistakes made. If the definition of self-improvement is doing better than you are right now, why not learn from someone who is currently doing better than you are right now?
Yeah.
Now, I know that I spent way too much of my 20s being jealous of other comedians rather than trying to learn what it was that they were doing to get farther ahead than I was. I feel like I'm not alone in this. Like, it's hard for any of us to watch the trajectory of someone who's been doing our job for less time, but then they get promoted before we do. Uh-huh. Looking back on it, there were some easy moves that I could have made if I would have just stopped telling myself that everyone else who did better than me was getting lucky. Several of the comics lived right in San Francisco, which is like the hub of comedy in the Bay Area, but it was an hour away from me. So I could only make it up there like every other night. And but everyone who lived there, obviously, they made it that much easier for them to get quality stage time. So while they were getting in the reps, I was doing less work and feeling more jealous.
So the energy spent comes out about the same.
I will say, though, that this only applies to things that you have control over, which is still valuable to focus on.
Yeah.
But if that coworker of yours who's in the middle of a meteoric rise within the company and they're also the boss's son, all of this goes out the window. But I do think this can be applied to everything from losing an Oscar nomination to a child actor to losing employee of the month at your job at the Foot Locker. Whatever it is, as much as it sucks to admit it, instead of dismissing the other person for winning, just learn how they beat you. So the takeaway for me is, don't be Kellen in his 20s.
All right, random facts. Here's a question from the book. Someone tells you they flipped a coin four times and every time it landed on heads. And she says, what are the odds of that happening? And I said, oh, 1 in 16. And she said, wrong, idiot. You don't know if it's a normal coin. And so now I know you should always check your assumptions or a female poker player will hurt your feelings.
So as I mentioned at the beginning, I don't know how to play poker. But because I don't know how to play poker, I'm always confused in movies where they're playing it. If characters are ever playing poker in a film, I constantly have to turn to my wife and ask, like, so how good was that good thing? Although, fun fact within a fun fact, I do know how to play Sabacc, which is a gambling card game that they play in Star Wars. So I followed that standalone Han Solo movie better than any of the other nine people in the theater.
My brother Ben once had a roommate, and every once in a while he would hear him talking to himself in the shower in just this low guttural speech. And he asked another friend and he was like, oh, he's speaking dark speech from Lord of the Rings.
Oh, man. So to be clear, this guy doesn't sing in the shower. He speaks the language of Mordor that isn't to be uttered amongst the elves. What a nerd.
And apparently he speaks multiple genuine languages. It's just that one that he speaks is dark speech. Kellen, have I told you about the time I bet $1,000 on a card game?
No.
So it's not even a sexy game like Texas Hold'em. It's a board game called Tortuga about pirates.
Oh, no.
I'm playing with a group of friends, and in the game, we know there's a traitor on our side called the Dutchman, and we've narrowed it down to Ben and Ethan, and we're pretty sure it's Ben because he's been acting fishy all game. So right before I have to decide who the traitor is, Ben says, I'll bet you $1,000 Ethan is the Dutchman, and everyone's jaw drops. And first off, Ben is pretty well off, and so I'm thinking, there's no way. He's been acting fishy the entire game. This must be like a crazy high-stakes bluff. And so I shook on it, and we bet $1,000 on the game. And everyone at the table was going crazy. They couldn't believe it. And then I was the Dutchman.
And now you have a huge Tortuga problem.
So he did pay me the $1,000. Earlier in the game, when he was sure he had won, he kept trying to let me out of the bet to be a good friend. So that made me a little guilty. So he Venmo'd me $1,000 and I Venmo'd back $950. I kept $50 to remind him of his hubris. And then he went on to date my ex-girlfriend. So never show mercy.
Also, I didn't know that you could use Venmo to transfer doubloons.
All right, I have my two favorite caroling stories that I'm so mad I forgot to tell in our Christmas carol episode. The first one is, one time my friends and I were in Salt Lake around Christmas time at night, and I said, pull over. And I rang a stranger's doorbell, and when they answered, I slowly sang all five verses of Good King Wenceslas by myself. My second favorite caroling story actually just happened. My mom wanted to go caroling, and we went to the house of some of our friends from high school. And after the song, we were giving hugs, and one of the women went to give me a hug, and my brother Johnny bumped her arm, and she punched me in the nose.
One of the most interesting facts from the book that should just be common sense for everyone, and I can't believe it took me this long to realize it. She mentions that, yeah, a prediction or a poll doesn't get it wrong unless it said the chance of whatever it is was 0%. And she gives the examples of, like, the polls said that there was, whatever it was, a 65% chance that Hillary would win. And then the next day, Trump gets the election and everyone's like, the polls were wrong. No, they still said he had a 35% chance. It was a smaller chance.
Yeah, I have heard the argument that says, instead, you should look at the pollster and see, when they say something has a 65% chance of happening, does it happen 65% of the time on average? Mm-hmm. But also, I think the person who said that was Nate Silver, whose poll was being criticized.
My wife and I had this discussion recently. I don't think that a weather app should be allowed to say that at 3 p.m. there's a 100% chance of rain. And then as you get closer to it, it's like, well, actually 80%. Well, maybe 40%. It's like, no, you told me. In the book, she also mentions the principle of hindsight bias, which is the idea of when we look into the future, it looks like there are limitless possibilities. But when we look into the past, it seems like everything was supposed to happen that way. Uh-huh. And she compares it to a tree that grows. And as it's growing, all of the lower branches get trimmed off so that looking above you, there are just, you know, dozens of branches going every which way, this all this potential. But looking back, there's just this singular trunk, as if today was the only possible outcome, as if there weren't possibilities before.
I think a lot of psychologists talk about this kind of thing where the world is essentially very unpredictable, very chaotic, and yet we want it to be orderly so much that when something bad happens to us, we would rather believe that that bad thing was predictable and we just failed to predict it than to believe that it is unpredictable. Because if we just failed to predict it, that means we can improve something to predict things better next time and prevent them from happening.
So to bring up Winnipeg for the first time in this episode, I've been there twice. The first time was actually getting close to spring. And in Winnipeg, instead of using salt, they use sand everywhere to melt the ice, which makes the entire city look like a mud pit. And I can't tell you how many people, when they found out that it was my first time in Winnipeg, they were like, it's not usually like this. So fast forward to the next year, Winnipeg has the biggest blizzard that they have had in 100 years.
Oh my gosh.
Tens of thousands of trees all over the city had just been crushed to the ground. Because something I never realized is that, like, one of the reasons why trees lose leaves is so that not as much snow will stick to them if that's where they live. Oh. It snows, and in a night, all the trees catch just thousands of pounds of snow and they all fall to the ground. So when I get there taxiing to my hotel, it's just blocks and blocks of tractors and street after street of this massive, like, state emergency cleanup. And then again, for that whole week, everyone is like, it's not usually like this.
I have a theory about why you've had so many miserable stand-up experiences, which is that if people were already having a good time, they wouldn't pay you to be there. All right, to recap our favorite lessons from Thinking in Bets. 1, beware of resulting. 2, regret stuff in the future. 3, when you ask advice, don't say the result. 4, learn from those who beat you.
And 5, as Thoreau said, shake that thing.
The hardest part about poker is getting hit in the balls with a rope.